a number of art schools in the early 60s said, clearly, it is the relationship of the painter to the medium that is the essence of painting. The painter must be emotionally present, and this is what we should instill in our students. And so they started to take away traditional training in art school of representational drawing, of color theory, of figurative drawing. And what they ended up with was a generation of artists who were passionately throwing paint at canvases, but unable to make art. So the relationship between the fundamentals and intuition is very complicated. I mean, nobody seemed to make the point that the great abstract expressionists were all trained for decades in traditional art school. That's what they came out of. And we see this in our analytic colleagues. Many of them are writing wonderfully at the moment, but they were trained as Kleinians or trained as ego psychologists, and they have that in their bone marrow. And the kind of representational work with Apple that I'm talking about, when I say I draw and I draw and I draw until I can put that aside, in analytic work, I go to something basic in my training. And for me, it happens to be something that's close to Paul Gray. It's not where I'm going to stop, but I can use Paul Gray because that's what I was trained in, and I will look for transference. I'll look for defense. I'd look for resistance, and I'll go back and look for the derivatives of certain affects that are enacted in the relationship. And I go over it and over it until I can relinquish it like I did with the painting of Apple. And then the intuitive comes in. But the intuitive is the reward at the end of decades of hard work.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, IPAoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Jonathan Palmer. Dr. Palmer is a psychoanalyst and a painter. And for me, it was a rare privilege to sit in conversation with a psychoanalyst who is deeply immersed in the psychoanalytic experience, who is also a creative artist and is deeply immersed in the creative process as it pertains to his artwork. And he shows us how, for him, there are remarkable similarities between the two and also notable differences. And one of the little gems that I found that you may perhaps enjoy as I did is he talks about the difference on the canvas and on the paper between oil paints and watercolor, and how there's a parallel in those unique properties to various types of engagements he has in the clinical encounter with Anna Lassands. And I will just say that to invite you to be curious to listen further. We talk further. We talk about how he sees the relationship between abstract painting and representational painting. And as I note at the beginning, there is a link to the paper itself that this is based off. It's a paper called The Aesthetic Matrix, A Conversation Between a Painter and a Psychoanalyst. And the importance of that link is not just to read his thinking in greater depth, but also there are two of his paintings that are linked to the paper that we discuss. And to his point, seeing the visual really brings alive much of his thoughts. We also discuss a clinical encounter where his painting unpacked a countertransference impasse he was in. And he also describes an event in his native South Africa that led him to certain appreciations of what it's like to live and work in America. I hope you find this as delightful as I did. Here's my conversation with Dr. Jonathan Palmer. John, welcome to the podcast. I'm so pleased to have you here. I've been looking forward to this conversation for some time. John, you are a painter and a psychoanalyst. And you've written an essay where you bring forward your ideas about how each of these creative experiences of yours interfaces with the other, and even more, how each can deepen the experience of the other. And we're going to spend time going through this essay to allow you to elaborate your thinking. Where you begin is at the beginning, with your mother, who was a painter and, as you say, your first teacher. And she gave you a phrase, if not an invitation as a child, that we borrowed to title our podcast. And that is, she said, "Before painting the bird, you must become the bird." And we'll go from that experience to the painting you made of your recently deceased dog, Apple, and what it was like for you to paint it. And you share it with the reader. I want to mention early on that in the show notes, there is a link to this paper that contains two images. One is the first image of Apple, and that's done in watercolor. And the second, which we will get to, is an oil painting that you did in relation to an analytic treatment that was stuck at the time. And we'll unpack that. So you begin the journey with your mother and then your dog, Apple. You share with us the difference for you, which I found fascinating, the difference, analytic difference for you of working in watercolors versus oil paint. And you also talk to us about the different meaning for you of working abstractly or in representation. And then, as I say, you get to a clinical vignette where you describe how the canvas allowed you to work out something that you and the patient had been unaware of. And there's a particular description of black paint that really, you know, if I had to find a piece of this description that really represents you and your thinking, it's that you don't buy black paint from a paint store. And let's hold that and we'll talk more about it. So to begin at the beginning, I will read a piece of the first paragraph from this paper. You write, "My mother, a painter, was the first of my teachers. As a child, I had a love of birds, which were plentiful in my childhood garden in South Africa and readily available subjects for painting. My mother instructed me, 'Before painting the bird, you must become the bird.' At the time, it felt like there was little need to question how this might be done. Entering the life of the bird felt natural, as it might only for a child. I loved birds. I could easily imagine being and feeling like a bird. I readily gave flight to my brush filled with paint across the paper. This uninhibited, spontaneous capacity of a child to become one with the other is something I now must work to even approximate. Joining and feeling the experience of the subject of a painting is essential."
Yeah, well, Harvey, firstly, thank you for this. I appreciate the invitation. So we start off with the painting of the bird, and what we're really starting off with is it's a very clear memory for me. It's my mother was a painter. I often drew birds, and I painted them with children's poster paints. And one day she said to me, you know, go into my studio, choose a canvas, take whatever oil paint you want, choose a brush, and you can go and paint a bird. But if you're going to paint that bird, you have to become the bird. And it felt like, you know, she was telling me to move a chair from one side of a room to another. There was nothing complicated about it. And looking back, I can see why, you know, Picasso said he spent his life trying to paint like a child. So the point of this is that I knew what I knew about a bird. I knew that I could go out there and paint a beak, feathers, wings, feet, and so on. But something more was being asked of me in the becoming a bird. I had to imagine myself into being a bird, the way we might do in our analytic work. But this is a particular kind of imagining, because you have to imagine yourself into the vitality of a bird. And often we are very good with our empathic imaginations, but the vitality, the vital spark of what makes a patient able to fly, if I can extend the metaphor, is something that we have to connect to. At any rate, this is the more intuitive dimension of capturing something in our work. So you have something that's happening between my mother and myself, and we are co-constructing this image of a bird that is between us and being transformed into something that is palpably alive, that comes from me and from her and the bird in joining. So that's the sentiment that I was trying to convey in this first little vignette.
Mm-hmm. And then you go directly to another animal, notably, and that is Apple, your recently deceased beloved dog. And you paint him and you write, "I know Apple's physicality, and looking now interferes with the intuitive seeing by my mind." And I'm going to say that again because it's an important theme throughout the paper. "Looking now interferes with the intuitive seeing by my mind. I try to relinquish any image which I might desire to produce." You go on to say, "This form of image making cannot be done intentionally. It must come spontaneously and intuitively. In the painting, the right shoulder held my experience of Apple. That is my becoming Apple. It is the process of intuitively finding and becoming, dreaming Apple, that is restorative and provides an experiential parallel to psychoanalytic work."
Okay, so just on the side, I do love painting people, but you know, you can't just put pictures of paintings of people you know into an art. So I also love animals, of course. But this is an example of me painting as an adult, right?
Right.
With all the inhibitions and restrictions and expectations of an adult. But it captures what I mean by working intuitively. So I have my own method of working intuitively that translates between my analytic work and my painting. What I do is I paint as carefully as possible to capture as accurate a depiction, in this case of Apple, as I can. And I do that over and over. And it comes from years of training in representational drawing. You know, we can bounce this to analytic work. You know, knowing the fundamentals and being able to listen to represented material and listen to symbolic material, for me is everything before you get to anything intuitive. So eventually with Apple, I do this over and over and over. And in watercolors, you do it, you throw it away. You do it, you throw it away. And eventually trying to capture what Apple looks like, the physicality of Apple, falls naturally into the background. It becomes less important. I sort of know it. I know how to do it. And I don't even have to look. I can almost do it just with my hand moving. And that's where it creates the opportunity to do something that's intuitive. Now, we do things that are intuitive all the time, but I have my own aesthetic or test of whether to hold on to the intuitive mark, which if you value it, it becomes an intuitive construction. If you don't, you call it an accident and you throw it away. But periodically, there's a mark that is valuable, like happened in Apple's shoulder. You know, there was a hesitation and there was a pooling of pain that all happened in a moment that rendered the pain in that shoulder. And I said, I got it. There I have it. And when I say I got it, it means that I've circled back and found that there's an aesthetic coherence to that particular mark. What I felt about Apple, what I knew about her pain, and what I could translate through the paint all came together. And when it comes together, that is the aesthetic matrix I'm talking about. That's the aesthetic experience. And then I say, okay, that's valuable. I can hold on to that.
And that, if I understand you right, you feel is both similar to and somewhat different from that moment, that clinical moment, because we may feel we got it in how we felt that clinical experience and perhaps how we communicated it. But it also takes a resonance from the patient to match and elaborate that I got it, which is different than the canvas. Is that a fair distinction?
Well, it's always both, right? It's so that Apple's painting this with me, if I can say that, right? And the patient's working with me. The difference in painting is you can be ruthless. You can make mistakes. And, you know, what's the downside? You throw it away and you take out another piece of paper. You can't do that with patients, right? So you have to be working internally. You have to be doing this work. You have to have an internal canvas to be able to paint on. Or you can have a reverie, but you don't share every reverie with the patient. You hopefully circle it through your own aesthetic, presence and figure out, does this work and how can I use it? So the immediacy of painting is sort of, you know, it's a luxury of ruthlessness.
The way you describe that in the papers, you write, the freedom to work intuitively in psychoanalysis is always more restricted than it can be in painting. And I assume that's what you're referring to.
But that's a little, I wrote it a little inaccurately. I mean, maybe what would be more accurate would be, say, to behave intuitively is restricted, right? We should work intuitively, but we should have our internal system of evaluating those intuitions and figuring out which to keep and which not.
The way you introduce in your paper the term aesthetic matrix, you write, there is a generative cycle of creativity and vitalization, which is common to both art and psychoanalysis. I call this the aesthetic matrix. In analysis, aesthetic experiences are often intuitively and spontaneously derived from unconscious communication. Appreciation of the aesthetic effects of our intuitive participation requires a sensitivity to subtle changes in the setting, the shifts which inform us of how emotions change.
Right. Okay, so we're moving along with this. So what happens is you have an intuitive experience in the analysis.
Uh-huh.
It's a feeling. It might be a reverie. It might be something that comes to mind, and then you engage the patient in it, and then you have to notice what the shift is in the setting. You know, how this has moved things along. And that becomes a sort of a second indicator of the value of whatever you've done intuitively. But the first indicator is, how does it feel intuitively? How does it feel aesthetically to you, right? Does this work to you? And then, is it something that you can bring the patient into?
And what I want to emphasize is something that is often not addressed as clearly as you just did, which is often people will stop after what you just said, and they will describe how authentic something feels or how theoretically attuned it is, and they may be pleased if it was theoretically attuned. And often people don't get to the second step, which you just clearly outlined, which is what it does with and to the patient, what the patient's associations, either at that moment or the next day, as it were, how that moves and potentially deepens their experience of themselves and of the matrix between the two of you. And I guess you say Apple is painting it with you, but not in the same way that the patient is co-creating it with you. And that's your honoring the patient's contribution to the co-creation, which warrants noting.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are these various levels. So if we think of, say, you know, firstly, I get to this later in the paper, the setting and the preparation to be able to work in my studio, you mm-hmm. know, I go into it in detail later in the paper, if for only one reason, to show just how much work I think is involved in getting to a place where you feel receptive in the way that I feel one needs to be. So in order to work analytically, the hovering attention that Freud talks about, or you know, the way of being with a patient is profoundly important. And I think to work intuitively, I think, is very, very difficult and takes a lot of time. So we have people who are very talented with reverie. I mean, that maybe that's the poetic form of what I'm considering painting. So you have a reverie, then, and internally, I think my first process would be, what is the aesthetic of this? How does it feel to me? Does this capture what I know and what I feel about the patient? So that's the first level. The second level is, now, if I bring this into the analytic work, in whatever manner, and it might be that I've said nothing, but it shifted the way I feel, and that shift in my feelings affects the way I respond moment to moment with the patient, and what has the consequence been in the emotional setting for the patient? Does the patient feel safer and more able to talk to me? So these are all hurdles and levels, right? So simply having a painting, having a reverie is only a beginning, and all the other has to be included.
You've always made the point that reverie is reverie. Even hovering attention is an essential aspect of our analytic presence. But like you say now, in terms of your technical training and your approach to representation, that you need the basics. You need to understand technique and theory about how the mind works, and you need to have it in your bones so that you could consciously forget it and then enter the state that you're characterizing as reverie.
Can I just interject a little story that I think
sure.
I've shared with you, but I'll share with the listeners, because I think it's important. So in the 1950s in America was the heyday of abstract expressionism. And I think everybody's familiar with de Kooning and Pollock and Rothko and Joan Mitchell and these wonderful painters. a number of art schools in the early 60s said, clearly, it is the relationship of the painter to the medium that is the essence of painting. The painter must be emotionally present, and this is what we should instill in our students. And so they started to take away traditional training in art school of representational drawing, of color theory, of figurative drawing. And what they ended up with was a generation of artists who were passionately throwing paint at canvases, but unable to make art. So the relationship between the fundamentals and intuition is very complicated. And I think nobody seemed to make the point that the great abstract expressionists were all trained for decades mm-hmm. in traditional art school. Right? That's what they came out of. And we see this in our analytic colleagues. Many of them are writing wonderfully at the moment, but they were trained as Kleinians or trained as ego psychologists, and they have that in their bone marrow. And the kind of representational work that or the work with Apple that I'm talking about, when I say I draw and I draw and I draw until I can put that aside, you have to go to, in analytic work, I go to something basic in my training. And, you know, for me, it happens to be something that's close to Paul Gray. It's not where I'm going to stop. That I can use Paul Gray because that's what I was trained in, and I will look for transference, I'll look for defense, I'll look for resistance, and I'll go back and look for the derivatives of certain affects that are enacted in the relationship, and I go over it and over it until I can relinquish it like I did with the painting of Apple. And then the intuitive comes in. But the intuitive is the reward at the end of decades of hard work.
John, bravo. That was really a beautiful description of the challenge of being an analyst and training analyst. So thank you for that. Thank you for that. Let me invite you to share with the listeners what you describe in the paper, which is the act of painting. And when you're facing the white canvas, what you write is representation in painting, melody in music, and theoretical constructs in psychoanalytic writing all come at the price of prescribing meaning. And this is a sensibility that I share in my abstract painting. Now, we're going to speak in a moment about the tension and the parallel with clinical work between abstract and representational writing. But walk the listener through, who haven't had the pleasure of reading your paper, about, you say, I begin my painting process with the hanging of a white canvas on my painting wall. Give us a flavor for, or a picture, better said, of what happens next.
Right. So in most parts, I don't have a preconceived idea of what I'm going to do when I go into my studio. Usually what I know is I have some time, right? And I go into the studio, and the light of day is very informative and important, the materials of art are something that one comes to love. So you take out a big roll of loose canvas, right? I buy it in rolls, and I cut out, say, usually it's large. I like to paint large, so it might be 7 feet by 5 feet. And I pin it to the wall, right?
Let me just ask you a perhaps irrelevant question, but I'm picturing you're doing this and you're buying it in rolls. Do you need a special scissor to cut the canvas?
I use a knife. I use a box cutting knife. You know.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. I'm with you with what you're describing. Go ahead.
Right. So I put the canvas up and with pins, and I usually put a plumb line on both sides so I have the verticals. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Once you have the verticals, you kind of you kind of have a sense of what you're going to do. Okay, then I have to sit down, right? Because, now we're in a place. And very often I will put on music. And typically, I go to jazz. I mean, sometimes I'll go to Bach and cello and Yo-Yo Ma. I mean, you know, he'll do magic for anybody. But, you know, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, you know, right. So you get imbued with a rhythm. And this becomes the first embodiment of the process. And listening to Coltrane, for example, the rhythm, the percussive aspects of it, it settles me. It settles me like I think a good analyst listening to finding a way to be emotionally in resonance with the patient can be settled. So it settles me. And I still have my canvas, and then I might still be not sure what the hell to do with this, right? So I go and I look at artists that I admire, and it's a little bit like reading in analytic work. You read a good paper or something, you look at good art. The good art, especially the classic good art, refines the retina, it makes it more receptive, and you want to step back a little from, your occipital cortex where you organize all the visual information to somewhere, you back up a little to where things get a little more disorganized so you can see constructively dissociated way. And then, I tend to put a little canvas, as I said in my thing, I put a little canvas on the side of my big canvas so that it becomes the place where I pretend I don't give a damn, but I can just do stuff. And that often is a very alive place for me. And then my paints are all organized as a big mess. And, I just keep it that way. And eventually some color occurs to me. Or some brush, captures my interest. And I go on, I make that first mark on the canvas, which, a spontaneous gesture of sorts. And very often I can quickly make something of the mark, and it's an attractive, pretty representation of something, because the mind wants to do that. So I say, I've just painted a horse. That's very nice. And I've learned to remove that, because that's a quick representation that's in fact just taking care of my anxiety. Picasso said that his work is the sum of the destructions, which I fully understand. So you erase that mark. But now it started a process, because when I erase that mark, I don't erase it to obliterate it completely. There's some remnant there. And then I grab onto that remnant and I start building. And there's a play between mark and color. And it's a little like, Winnicott used to do his own squiggle games with himself. Mm-hmm. And so this is a play that goes back and forth. And I try to be surprised by what happens, and whether I hold on to it or not is all about the aesthetic of what eventually emerges.
Do you know when you're facing a blank canvas if what you will create will be either representational or abstract?
No. This representational versus abstract, I mean, we can break it down in a variety of ways. The one thing that I think for me that Winnicott gave us is that place where, in that transitional place, where it's unclear whether you have found something or created it, that is not being the issue. The place of whether it's representational or non-representational not being there, it's the in-between place. It's the transitional place that has the power of creativity in my mind. So even now, you know, you get people caught between between knowing and being, between the ontological and epistemological. It's sort of an old dichotomy. You know, Winnicott would say, go through the gap in the middle. That's where you're going to get your yield. That's what Cezanne did. I mean, Cezanne said the Impressionists were trying to capture the feeling. And he said, but there's a tree there. But there's a house there. I want that in there. He said, I'll give you the truth. The truth is in between those two things. Mm-hmm. And he said, that's how a child can see. So, no, it's neither. The idea, and I think I mentioned this in the paper, the idea is neither to represent nor not to represent, right? It's allowing it to emerge. But I am sensitive to early, quick, facile representations that I think are cheap bribes to stop painting.
And you make that point in the clinical setting, you write, in psychoanalysis, symbolic material can be used to expand analytic understanding, but can also remove the patient and the analyst from being emotionally present. Imagination can be constricted by an urgent, and that may be the key word, urgent reaching for representation. Holding the non-representational space within the dyad without urgency can allow the patient to fully benefit from the emotional containment of the aesthetic experience. The patient can then unconsciously modulate the evolution from formlessness to representational forms. Like the viewer of Rothko, representational narratives will often come to the patient, and these representations are frequently a reflection of the emotional work that transpired before the representational narratives became available.
Okay, I like that.
You agree with that, yeah?
I would write that again.
Yeah. But I don't want to lose the point you made when describing your process of painting. This issue of the meaning of working in watercolor versus oil paint, just to stimulate your thinking, you write, there are such times in an analytic relationship when I can be my most intuitive and spontaneous self, like painting with watercolors. The relationship is at a point where my failures are well tolerated. It is often late in an analysis that I can move to watercolor. Fill us non-painters in on
Can we back up to your earlier comment?
Okay,
Really responded. I thought it was important.
Yeah.
This issue of representation, right? Representation is hugely important, but when and how and who does it come from? And when do you know that it's in keeping with the emotional resonance of a patient and analyst? So I think we all love this oft-repeated piece by Winnicott that he wished that he had waited and rather than interpret. So what's he doing while he's waiting? My point is that the emotional containment of non-representation allows the ripening of the representation in the mind of the patient to the point that it becomes most useful, valuable, and authentic to the patient. And sometimes it needs a little help from us, but it needs a help in the language of the unsaturated interpretation or interpretation sort of as enzymes to the process of the patient. So it's a matter of timing. I think that when we come to a conviction that we understand and we're way ahead of the patient, firstly, there's a certain arrogance to that position. And secondly, even if we happen to be right in some way, it's not useful. So it's holding the patient in this non-representational place that is emotionally containing and I think facilitating towards representation. that safety comes first. Okay.
Is that similar to the well-recognized idea clinically that something must be affectively alive, which may be similar to what you're saying, to tolerate the non-representational state? Something must be affectively alive, and ideally affectively alive in the office. And from that, the symbolic meaning, not to mention its genetics, can then be elaborated. But staying in tune to where the patient is, referring back to Paul Gray, it's helping the patient get access themselves as opposed to telling them what their meaning is. Is that similar to what you're saying?
It's very similar. So the first part of that, how do you reach emotional or affective attunement with a patient? And I'm always intrigued about young analysts who, you know, candidates who come to us, and patients can't keep coming to them. They haven't yet had training. They don't yet know the language they're going to learn. They have a capacity to be in tune and affectively connected to their patients. Hmm. It's a capacity that we need to make sure they hold on to while they learn all the other stuff. Otherwise, they end up with some kind of false progression. That core efficacy that they come to us with, where they can be in tune with the patient. So my sense is that this form of being, that you can be present with the patient, and once that happens, patients feel safe, because it's all about feelings, and feelings are in the body, and we talk about embodiment, and once patients feel safe and the anxiety diminishes, they're more willing to talk to us and more able to talk to us. So that is the, and very often there's a, in my mind, there's a creative element that comes from it. You know, Winnicott said that creativity is the doing that comes from being. That when we're doing this, we're going to create in one fashion or another. A lot of people are creating by, they are, in their own minds, they might have the talent for reverie, or they might be writing clinically, but someplace they can create, which is like my little canvas on the side, you know.
You know, there was a slight shift in how you responded to what I said that may be worth noting. I spoke about the importance of allowing the patient's affective immediacy be in the room from which the symbolization, representation, and memory can emerge. And you took that and you called and you spoke of the analyst's attunement. I actually wasn't referring to that, though it's obviously an important part of the process of allowing the patient's affective immediacy. But, and I don't know if this is a difference, maybe, that the patient's affective immediacy could be of all sorts, love, hate, desire, frustration, sorrow, I mean, all of it, in relation to the transference. And that's, I guess, one's attunement will allow that. But it's not the same as the analyst's attunement. It's the patient's affect.
Okay, so that, I mean, you know, maybe we see it a little differently, but yeah. I think the way I see it is that the emotional affective attunement has to be there. So it might speak more to that section on color in my paper.
Perfect segue.
Okay, it's not about the patient and the analyst having been on the same page effectively. It's about the analyst being attuned and in sync with the patient, you know, the so-called at-one-ment. You can have very different feelings, but there has to be an aesthetic resonance. Otherwise, the patient is alone and afraid.
Now, let's get back to this watercolor thing, which I think is so cool.
Okay.
All right. It never occurred to me to differentiate watercolor and its interface with analytic immediacy. So share with us what that means to you, working in those two mediums.
All right. You know, clearly by analogy, we're talking about, you know, the medium of watercolor and the medium of words and analysis, mm-hmm, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I think that's understood. So in watercolor, you get good watercolor paper. You're right. You know, 300-pound cold pressed Archer's paper, and you get good watercolor, and a fine brush. Putting that paint, say a black or red paint, onto the paper has a beauty in and of itself that I don't think can be equaled with any other medium. It's just very beautiful the way the paper absorbs. You know, the paper becomes as much as a part of the medium as does the paint. The paper absorbs the water out of the pigment. The pigment sits on top of the paper, and it's a thing of beauty. The problem is, you know, what the hell do you do when you make a mistake, right? And with watercolor paper, you can't, in my mind, you can't really reverse the mistake. So there are all these techniques of you can use a blade and scrape the paint off, and then the paper won't receive the paint the same way. So mm-hmm. then there are little tools to compress the paper and try and make it receptive. So in essence, the full receptivity of the medium and the paper shifts. So you got to get it right. So in analysis, but if you get it wrong, you can throw it out and start again. So in analytic work, that spontaneous comment, right, that is fresh, alive, and in the moment, right, you can only make it with a patient who can tell you, throw that out. Mm-hmm. It's not working for me, right? Mm-hmm. But it's a wonderful tool to have with patients where you've come enough distance that the relationship can tolerate that kind of mistake. So it's often late in an analysis where patients know that you write about, you know, 40% of the time, and they throw up, and they tell you, and then you try again. But the spontaneous mark is a gift to the work.
Versus oil painting?
Oil painting is very different. I mean, you can get the intensity of color in oil painting that it's close to watercolor. It dries with great intensity. But the biggest difference, I think, in terms of the analogy, is that it's malleable, right? You can scrape it off. You can add to it. It'll be wet the next day. You can paint over it. So there's lots of room to make mistakes. And then when you add so-called aesthetic marks, you can do it gently. So if you're doing a landscape, and you're out there and it's early morning, and yesterday you painted in the afternoon, and in the early morning you see, you know, there's just a blush of purple next to that tree, right? You know there's mm-hmm. no purple out there, but you see a blush. So you add it, but you can add it thinned out. You know, the way in which the field theorists like to talk about unsaturated interventions or interpretations, the paint can be unsaturated. It's less pigment. So you add it, and then you can add, and then you can layer the paint. So you can gently, in small measure, move to something more aesthetically appealing. And then when it doesn't work, you take a rag and you wipe it off. Right? So it's a much more flexible medium.
Hmm. More characteristic to follow your analogy with the early work of an analysis.
Yes. And sometimes you can never go to watercolor. You know, right.
Now, you write about a patient that you call Jack and how your painting played a part in your evolving understanding of what was happening in you and in him. And you write, there are times when I will do an actual painting in response to the emotional experience of an analysis. Sometimes the patient is on my mind, and I'm not surprised to see the analytic experience in the painting. Other times, I'm not consciously thinking of a patient, but once in the midst of the painting process, it becomes evident to me that the painting is about the patient. Now, before I ask you to introduce Jack to us, I do want to go back to that reference to black paint, because for me, it was one of the highlights of the paper. As it will become clear to anyone listening, you're not someone who works formulaically. You don't take a theoretical construct and just apply it because you feel like it. And likewise, to extend the metaphor, you don't buy black paint from a paint store. You, and I'm reading now, I mix my own. I mix three vibrant, alive colors, an intense red, a rich, transparent green, and a beautiful deep blue. The result is an intense black paint which contains the aliveness of the three colors. And this is one of those descriptions that I don't know if it needs any commentary. It sort of stands on its own. So let's just leave that there as you wrote it and talk to us about Jack.
All right. So Jack came to me, a man in his 50s, and, you know, from day one, he was combative, right? And pretty much everything I did failed to be helpful. And I couldn't find a way in. And he was clearly hurting and very, very angry, and a background of significant deprivation. And, you know, I had Ferenczi's paper on the unwanted child in mind, you know, that this fit with his history, and he deeply wanted something of me, but rejected anything that I could give. And I had Winnicott's fear of breakdown in mind. And there were powerful, you know, Oedipal themes in the room. His yearning for me was very powerful. Was it a father hunger? Was it a more homosexual yearning? So I had a lot of theoretical ideas which sit out there, right? But the problem with this was I couldn't find an emotional resonance with him. That I couldn't find a way that we could be in tune, that I could match his pain or his anger with some kind of emotional state that would keep us connected and in tune, for want of a better word. And then there's this little vignette where, you know, he says, what did he say? That he has a headache and worried that it's a brain tumor or a stroke. And I say it can be both, right? Now, there's not quite enough information in that little interchange to know, you know, what's really going on between us. But I knew how I felt. And what I felt at the time was the kind of irritability and distance that was not appropriate for what I would be aiming at in a clinical situation. And in essence, I felt that I was retaliating to his comment in a fashion that felt more sadistic than I was at all comfortable with. So I just started to try and paint that. Could I access something about what was happening between us emotionally? And the painting, as I depict, conveys the depression in the black. It conveys, you know, in the breakdown of the black, the way I break down the black with it, there's a little green and then a final red streak across that for me represented this rage, you know, aliveness, this rage masquerading as aliveness. But through the painting, I could now feel the intensity of the depression. So what was missing, I think, was that I could know the depression, I could formulate the depression, I could intellectualize the depression, but feeling it in his presence had escaped me. The painting brought me towards that feeling. And something shifts when you actually feel the depression and then the vulnerability and just the nature of the anxiety and the depth of the anxiety that he was feeling. The emotional setting of the analysis shifts. I can't tell you anything in particular that I said subsequently, but I suspect that everything I said was quite different. And this patient has settled down tremendously since that painting.
Let me invite you to read the final paragraph or so of the paper where you reflect on how your painting changed things within you, gave you access to something that was elusive, and then that change in you changed the process with him.
Okay. I did a painting in response to an impasse in the analytic process. The painting provided a cohesive emotional aesthetic experience. The aesthetic experience changed my emotional presence. Translating this emotional content into words allowed me to be conscious of emotions not previously recognized. My receptivity changed significantly with positive changes in the analytic rapport and Jack's overall well-being. The ensuing analytic work supported my intuition that Jack feared an underlying depression, which he conflated imaginatively with dying. Newly shared history revealed profound early neglect, strongly suggesting a childhood depression. I began to understand how my intuitive appreciation of the depression he feared kept me at bay. I must have unconsciously known it to have painted it. There was a horror to be experienced that I too wanted to avoid. Subsequent months brought a consolidation of our relationship in important ways. Jack has become less fearful, though sadder. He is less prone to feeling slighted and rejected, and the deep fear of aloneness is a smaller monster at the door. It might be time for a new painting.
John, before I thank you, I want to address, I don't know if this is like the canvas that we have been painting on, but there is a background theme that would be easy to ignore, and that is your accent. And that speaks, as you alluded earlier, to your South African origins. And let's not ignore the quality and the nature of this canvas. And you have shared with me an experience you had, just a sampling of your experiences when you lived there, that relates to our clinical work. And can I ask you to share that with our listeners?
Yeah, so I left South Africa in 1982, and I was in medical school during the height of apartheid. And I think what I've shared is the setting of analysis or psychotherapy, just the extent to which it can be affected by the political and societal context in which it's happening. So I was in therapy with somebody as a medical student who was disappeared by the security police. One day I showed up and for my session and nobody knew where he was. And it turned out that a colleague of his had betrayed him to the security police, and he was in solitary confinement for a period of time. So I had to give some thought to that relationship and, a little bit reeling from somebody who disappears and you don't really know whether they're alive or not. And the assumption is that they've been arrested, which turned out to be the case, but you don't really know, and you don't know the conditions. So I got referred to somebody else to help me with the situation. And his opening comment to me was, "So your therapist had trouble with authority." So, these are considerations that we're fortunate not to struggle with in this country. If a patient has trouble trusting us in the initial part of a treatment. We wonder what in their history or might have made that possible. In so many countries in the world, it would be naive to trust a stranger, and you really don't know who might be, on the wrong side politically, and what danger it might put you into. You know, it's a blessing to be able to work in America. Mm-hmm.
And we have heard similar stories from our Argentinian colleagues as well during the period of their dictatorship. Though it is true nowadays, I find that people are often hesitant to speak freely because they assume insistently at times an imaginary agenda that the analyst has that will limit or condemn them for this or that thought, which is important but very different than actually potentially being arrested, which is the point that you're making.
Right.
John, I want to thank you, not only on behalf of myself, but on behalf of our listeners who really have received a treat, something different for us, that is to really feel what you're presenting is enriched by the paintings that are on the paper that is linked. It makes your point because to see the paintings and to feel your description of it so fleshes out and brings alive, speaking about affectively alive, the experience of your words, that the combination is just delightful. So we will also include the link to your artwork, which is not to be missed. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.